You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. It's your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, with Claire O'Sullivan from the great country of Ireland. This is the first time we've had anyone on our podcast in 3 years from Ireland. So, how are you, Claire?
I'm great, Alan. How are you?
Good. It's wonderful to hear the Irish brogue, don't you think?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I saw your picture and you seem like a very enthusiastic and knowledgeable guest scholar, as I call all of our various interviewees. I'm rather excited about this. I know little to nothing about Irish rock art, so I listened to that YouTube video with interest. We just had another gentleman on this preceding podcast to talk about those tombs that they find in Europe, the mounds and the rock tombs. But I think what you're going to talk about is something slightly different, correct?
Yep, that's it. It's definitely different, yep.
So, Claire, what I like to do, which is different from, I think, what you've experienced before, I like to get in your mind and your spirit first. Give us a snapshot, a thumbnail, a bit of an autobiographical portrait of how someone like yourself gets involved and passionate with your study of rock art. That would be very, very interesting to our audience, and always is.
Okay, cool. Well, firstly, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm delighted to be here to chat to you about Irish rock art today. So I suppose how I got into rock art, well, into the North Atlantic rock art, was when I was doing my undergrad and I was doing my thesis, I chose the topic of megalithic rock art. So I was looking at, you know, Newgrange, the UNESCO heritage sites, internationally. I was looking at Loch Crew Passage Grave in County Meath, and it was kind of the megalithic art that really intrigued me. And the more I delved into it, and the more I kind of learned and understood about it, the more it actually made me realize, and I found out that there was another kind of rock art, the Atlantic rock art style. So that was really exciting, because I suppose it is a lesser known aspect of Irish archaeology and of rock art. You know, a lot of people would know rock art in the form of the megalithic art and, you know, Loch Crew, Newgrange, Passage Grave cemeteries, whereas this rock art is lesser known, but personally, I think even more exciting. So I suppose then when I completed my undergraduate thesis, I just couldn't wait to delve further into this unique or this kind of art. And that's what brought me here, I suppose.
Now, expose us to exactly what this style of rock art is. I know you've talked about it in that YouTube video, but for people who are unfamiliar with it, let's go into some great detail about exactly the landscape, context, and the character of this rock art, please.
Yeah, for sure. So this rock art in Ireland is very much found in open air rural landscapes. So my study area would have been the southwest, so Cork and Kerry. And the landscapes that I would have been looking at, they would have been very, very rural. They would have been, you know, boggy landscapes in Cork and Kerry. And the art would occur on boulders and outcrops, mostly sandstone boulders and outcrops. And they would occur in clusters throughout, I suppose, in Ireland. The distribution would be Cork, Kerry, Wicklow, Carlow, Donegal, Louth, Monaghan. And there are isolated examples elsewhere. For example, a very famous example of the Atlantic rock art would be the Bohay Stone in County Mayo. But that, as far as I'm aware, is the only example of the Atlantic rock art in that area. Whereas the study area in the southwest, for example, in Kerry, the landscapes of Kilduff, Upper, Cuma Saharan and Leader West in particular have hundreds of examples of the Atlantic art in very, very close proximity. So the characteristics of the art, the key characteristics, and they do share some of the motifs with the megalithic art. So they'd be a cut mark would be one of the main motifs, and a cut mark is a circular man-made depression. And that would be surrounded by a ring or multiple rings and sometimes radial grooves. And these would occur in different formats, in different distributions across the surfaces of these panels in the open air, in these rural landscapes. So you could have anything from a cut mark with two rings on one panel to, you know, 20 cut marks with, like, you know, I think there's an example in, I think, is it a Leader West where there's like, you know, like I think like 9 or 10 rings around it. So, you know, and it does, there is quite a, like, you can see regional variation then as well within the different landscape clusters. But it's a very exciting type of art.
This type of art is very reminiscent of something, believe it or not, throughout California. Can you believe it?
Wow.
And a woman who's the vice president of the California Rock Art Foundation, Donna Gillette, did her PhD on this kind of rock art. She has coined a new name for it. She calls it a PCN. And it has to do with this cup and ring sort of element. Now, this expression only occurs on, let's say, serpentine or greenstone kinds of rocks all along the coast of California.
Oh, wow.
And there's hundreds, probably thousands of examples. And they, again, are in profusion, some of them, hundreds on boulders, maybe sometimes, never a thousand, but a hundreds. And what she hypothesized based on their distribution and some limited ethnographic information, that they have something to do with female fertility.
Okay. Cool. That's really interesting. I suppose what we do lack in the context of the Atlantic art in Ireland is the ethnographic information and the ethnographic context, because there are no, I suppose, when you look at, like, you know, global rock art, you have, for example, do you know the paintings in, you know, for example, South Africa and Australia?
Yeah, of course.
You can see those really, like, those really, really cool, you know, motifs, and, you know, they actually, like, I suppose you can see those, you can associate them with, you know, particular traditions with particular people, where this is so abstract and it is prehistoric in Ireland. It's so hard to kind of, I suppose, put any kind of, you know, I suppose, to make a definitive answer as to what it actually means.
Well, let me ask you this question. What stage of development in culture would produce this? In other words, how many thousands of years ago And what was the subsistence settlement arrangement that was correlated with these cup and ring expressions?
Okay, so that's really interesting, because as well as the lack of ethnographic evidence, and there's actually no figurative carvings either in the North Atlantic tradition, there is also, I suppose, there is a serious lack of chronological evidence as well, because there's only been one excavation ever that took place in Ireland, and it was in a site called Drumarill in County Monaghan. Dr. Blaise O'Connor completed that excavation as part of her PhD thesis in the early 2000s. And that is the only, to date, the only excavation of a rock art site in Ireland. And within that excavation, they did discover some Neolithic, some evidence of, I suppose, of the Neolithic time period. Whereas previously, I suppose people may have considered it, you know, later. They presumed that the passage grave art was earlier, like 3300 BC in around the Newgrange era. And then the North Atlantic type would be the Bronze Age, so like 2500. Whereas I suppose that excavation and then, you know, other research, I suppose, carried out by Joanna Valdez Tule more recently kind of makes you think that, you know, it does date to an earlier time period.
And what time period would that be?
It would be the Neolithic.
And what is the date on that?
It would be like 3,300-ish BC.
So about 5,000 years ago, correct?
Correct.
Very, very interesting. Now, the lithology on these, is it always sandstone?
It's not always sandstone. There are examples, I suppose, in Wicklow. I think the bedrock in the region would be granite. But in my study area, the area that I would be most familiar with is all sandstone. So it's in the southwest and it's all sandstone and a lot of like peaty podzol soils. So that would be the, I suppose, the most used rock in that region for the art.
Is there any other physical archaeological associations, artifacts, sites, different elements that are intimately associated with these cup and ring expressions?
I suppose you do have the Newgrange, the passage, the megalithic art. So you would have the cup and rings. They would appear in Newgrange and in Loch Crew. You would see those motifs, but they'd be in, I suppose, a different style completely to the Atlantic rock art type. But I suppose there's not that I can think of, to that question, but that I suppose these very rural landscapes, there is rich archaeological records in these rural landscapes, you know, and there are other prehistoric monuments. There are examples of, you know, some carvings on stone circles, which would come later than the Neolithic. Okay. So I suppose there are some examples, but not to the extent of the actual North Atlantic rock art.
And the Newgrange facility, is that not where there's a tremendous amount of white quartz exhibited?
Yes. Now, that's in the reconstruction, I suppose. So when they excavated it originally, they did find that there was the quartz. They did find evidence for the quartz. So then when they, you know, did the reconstruction, they did put white quartz around the outside.
Well, in terms of the sandstone and the granite, that's rather interesting. And is there any, in comparative forager theology, is there anything that seems to be akin to this that one might say could potentially even be a distant analog?
I'm not sure. That's a really interesting question. But to be honest, I'm really unsure of that one.
Yeah, yeah. And this is what my mind works, because I know that our friend Donna Gillette had the same exact issues as yours. Really no ethnography at all, but looking at comparator world ethnology and also trying to wrap one's mind around what these particular features could have been. Now, you have some working hypotheses about the function, meaning, or potential cultural context, do you not?
Yeah, no, for sure. And there has been so many theories over the years on, you know, to explain these carvings. And I suppose the one that I would lean most towards would be that they were boundary markers within prehistoric societies. And there has been a lot of study done on like viewshed analysis.
Yeah, context, viewshed analysis, correct.
Yeah, that's it. And actually, there was a recent study done by Caitlin O'Neill on how to reconstruct paleo environments around these, around the view sheds, which is a really interesting study. So I suppose there are a number of theories that you could say there was some theories put forward that it was associated with, a water cult. And that was actually put forward by but it was by John Sheehan, who's a professor at UCC. He basically suggested that because the rock art in the southwest region, especially on the Evra Peninsula in Kerry, where a lot of the study that I did was carried out, or where a lot of the rocks are located, he suggested that it could be there could be a connection to a water cult because of the distribution along the tributaries of rivers, and if you look, for example, especially at the Letter West landscape, all of the rock art are dotted around the streams and the rivers within the landscape. So that is a theory. There's the viewshed analysis, there's the boundary markers. So there are quite a number.
I like it. Cool. Let's leave it right there on the hinge of the mystery.
Okay.
We'll call that segment one. See you in the flip-flop, gang, and we'll continue this wondrous conversation. Welcome back, gang, to your Rock Art Podcast, only one in the world. And we welcome you to listen in with our friend Claire, who's talking about the rock art of Ireland. And this is the Cup and Rings. And absolutely fascinating. I was really unaware of this North Atlantic Cup and Ring tradition. Claire, you were just getting into discussions of some of the cutting edge state of technology that archaeologists are now using to study this class, this grouping, this remarkable expression of rock art. Please continue.
Okay, cool. Yeah, well, I suppose there's a lot of new technologies in recent years that have been employed to record the art. What I am most familiar with is photogrammetry and laser scanning. And I suppose that is such a huge thing and a huge development in terms of coming from a conservation point of view, where my research was very much on how to conserve the art and how to record the art and maybe analyze the human and natural agencies that lead to the loss of art. So what was huge for my research was the implementation of photogrammetry and laser scanning, because those non-invasive technologies actually allow, you know, the recording of the surface of the panels. And with the laser scanning in particular, you have an absolutely fantastic 3D model of the rock surface. And there was a few cases where this model actually showcased further cup motifs than had been originally recorded, say, for example, in the 50s and 60s. And that was great because they had been, I suppose they were eroded and affected by weathering. Therefore, you couldn't see them with the naked eye. But the laser scanning technology really, really helped bring them out. And with the laser scanning in particular, another fantastic thing about it is once you have the models, or with the photogrammetry, once you have the models, you can upload them to channels like Sketchfab, where they can be accessed and seen by, you know, people internationally, which is just fantastic. Because when you think about it, and especially here in Ireland, weathering and erosion is such a huge, you know, it's such a threat to rock art, you know, with the freeze thaw action and the constant rain. You know, it's great to be able to record the art. So at least, you know, you have the in situ position of it. You have the surface, you know, the motifs on the surface, you have it recorded, you have the coordinates, so you know where it was. So for example, if that was to be completely eroded or, you know, moved by farmers or destroyed accidentally, you would have, you know, you'd understand the actual landscape setting of it. So if you needed that then to further understand the context of that landscape region, you'd have it. So I'm a huge believer in laser scanning and photogrammetry and other non-invasive technologies to assist in the recording of rock art. I think it really does help. And I think there's been so many fantastic community-led projects on that. And especially the Scottish Rock Art group have done an awful lot in recent years on promoting that.
Here in the States, we're using that, you know, somewhat extensively. One of our board members for the California Rock Art Foundation is on the cutting edge of such technology globally, worldwide. He gets retained. He comes out of Hollywood, and he's doing the virtual reality work, the unbelievable stuff that he can recreate the actual three-dimensional environment with a headset, and you could sort of be there and experience that rock art in a way. They've elevated it to such a incredible, sophisticated level. You can count the sand grains, you can turn your head and see the sky, and it just, it's mind-blowing. And a gentleman who's a colleague of mine, another colleague of mine, just finished his master's degree at USC, and he studied the hunting blinds in an area of basalt and looked at the landscape context, the intervisibility of these particular features, and the way to test hypotheses on whether indeed they could and should have been used in the hunting and slaying of bighorn sheep. And I see how, you know, such a level of sophistication could then be applied to your data set. Now, you were just alluding on the break to some of the hypotheses about the nature, the cultural context of these cup and ring boulders.
Yes, for sure. And I suppose the context, as I mentioned earlier, it's so hard to kind of get a chronology and I suppose kind of put it into its rightful, you know, cultural context. But I suppose the biggest thing with these prehistoric carvings and the Atlantic rock art style is that they are, you know, in terms of their distribution, it's still in very rural settings. And that is because now we have lost a number of them due to land clearing and things like that. There are records that go back such a long time in Irish records that basically say, you know, some of them were actually blown up with dynamite. Some of them were removed, you know, farmers would remove them from the land and you'd never actually fully understand the context of them. But I suppose what is really interesting is that the large clusters of them, the landscapes that have like hundreds of them, they're very much peaty podzol soils. So, you know, they wouldn't be arable land. They wouldn't, you know, be good for farming. The land wouldn't be good for farming. It wouldn't be somewhere where people would actually settle. So those landscapes are virtually untouched. Unfortunately, I suppose you do have the development, the Letter West site, which is my favorite site that I've ever visited. It's just so magical. They've actually recently put a water treatment plant there. Now, it doesn't affect the actual rock art panels as they are protected under national legislation, but it does, I suppose, make the landscape not look as untouched as it did previously.
Yes, it certainly intrudes on the aesthetics, of course. Now, you said that one of the working hypotheses was regarding sort of the association of these features, these cup and ring rock art sites, with water. Is that correct?
Yes, I did mention that. John Sheehan had written that in a publication about the Iveragh Peninsula. So the Iveragh Peninsula is arguably the highest concentration of rock art in Ireland. So the Inishowen.
Really?
The Inishowen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really cool because you have like Letter West and Kiel Duff on one side of the peninsula, and then you have Derry na Blatha and Derrynie on the opposite side of the peninsula, like basically straight across. And Derry na Blatha and Derrynie came to quite significant fame, I suppose, through Emmanuel Anati in the 60s. He first recorded them with Elizabeth Shee. But I suppose when you think about the... Going back to your question, sorry. Yes, John Sheehan did theorize that there was an association, a possible association to a water cult, and that was because of its distribution very, very close to water sources. And that was another thing then that Avril Purcell, who did research on the region in the early 90s, she also said, you know, noted the distribution all along the river valleys and the tributaries of rivers, that they were, that's how they were distributed. So that is definitely an interesting theory.
What would they mean? What would that imply? What would they mean by a water cult?
I suppose what they would, my interpretation of that would, that it would be, you know, I suppose connected to the water source and, you know, be a, I suppose reflective of, you know, the esteem that the communities would have had for the water source or something like that. That's my interpretation of it. I suppose there are other theories in terms of, you know, boundary markers. And there was another theory, like in terms of what Richard Bradley and Avril Purcell also echoed it, is the fact that, you know, the... And this is true in some cases, but not in others, but that the further you go up in some of the landscapes, the more intricate, you know, I suppose, the wow factor of the art. So, for example, you know, in Derry na Blatha and in some parts of Letter West, the further up the mountain and the further up the routeways through the landscape that you go, the more elaborate the art is, and the more, you know, the more motifs are there, the different variations of the motifs. And there were theories put forward that that could be that the different classes within society would, I suppose, have access to the different styles of art. So it would be kind of aimed at different groups in society and the more elaborate stuff compared to the plainer art. So that was definitely a theory that was put forward.
When you say, you know, when you go up, is it higher in elevation? Is it more mountainous? Are they, do they change in their geomorphological context?
So, yeah, so basically, yes, there are some cases. Now, that is not like true throughout the whole country, because then you have examples, like I mentioned earlier, about the Bohay Stone of Mayo. That's an extremely elaborate decorated surface, and that there is no other pieces of art around that. And that is, you know, that's on its own. Whereas, yes, in some cases, especially in Derry na Blatha, for example, one of the most famous rocks there, I think it's categorized as Rock 10A. That's up quite high in the landscape, for like higher up in elevation for sure. And that is arguably the most elaborate one there.
Well, I do know, I always step in and I'm constantly thinking about the theological implications of all this. As we elevate and get closer to some sort of celestial, you know, or divine priest, you know, stratum, that would make perfect sense, wouldn't it? In terms of seeing those rocks become more and more complex, intricate, aesthetically pleasing, and, you know, part of that theology, wouldn't it or no?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And the beauty of it, the beauty of the, I suppose, lack of context, lack of ethnographic evidence, is the fact that, you know, there are so many theories that you can explore. You know, there's endless theories on this, and that is definitely one worth considering for sure.
Now, I know your emphasis and passion is on protecting these features. Am I correct?
You are indeed, yep.
And so I would assume that you had to come up with some rather creative strategies to deal with issues of cultural and natural impacts.
Yeah, I mean, it was so interesting and it was so exciting when I was researching this topic, particularly like when you look at different countries. For example, if you think about Australia, you think about South Africa, and you think about some other countries in Europe, they actually have rock art specific legislation within their, you know, heritage legislation. Whereas we have the National Monuments Act that protects any listed archaeological monument. So that if anyone was to damage an archaeological monument, they would be breaking, you know, that would be completely illegal. But that's only if the art is actually, if the panel is actually reported, if it's recorded, if it's been, you know, if they're aware of it, which is an issue to an extent with the Peaty Bogland areas where the art is now, you know, being recorded in quite high volumes, because the bog is starting to recede and that exposes some panels that have been covered for quite a while. So that, I suppose, that could, like, it's great that there is, you know, such renewed interest and people recording the art in the in these regions, because that definitely, you know, obviously then extends the protection of the legal guidelines to that panel. But there are some, I suppose, that would pop up and people might not, you know, they might not be recorded. But I suppose in terms of protecting them, definitely with the National Monuments Act, that is fantastic. That does, for any reported panel, that does cover that. But I suppose the biggest thing to worry about is the natural agencies, like the weathering and erosion and stuff like that. And also a huge thing is promoting and increasing awareness of this rock art type in Ireland, because it's lesser known and because it's very rural. There are some people that, you know, wouldn't be aware of the significance of it. So in terms of like land clearing and farming and things like that, they might not be aware what treasures they have on their land. So a huge thing is actually raising awareness. So as part of my research, I did go out to communities. I went out to schools, tourist offices and things like that, and spoke to them about the art in the region and, you know, how significant it was, and tried to put it in the wider national context as well as the wider global context. So that was great to kind of instill a sense of local pride in the region and in the monument type. Then another thing that I did then was create a rock art code, which was then later published by the Heritage Council here in Ireland. So that was basically, you know, 10 steps of how to, you know, visit a rock art site and how to engage with in a non, you know, detrimental way.
Fantastic. The rock art code. I love it. I've never heard of that before, but that's fantastic. How wonderful, creative, wonderful, and impactful. Well, with that, let's call that a segment, and we'll see on the flip-flop for numero tres, number three, and we'll go into some final thoughts. Welcome back, gang, to your Rock Art Podcast on the Rock Art Podcast platform. This is the 10th year, and I want to congratulate Chris Webster for reaching his 10th anniversary. And we have with us a remarkable woman who's dedicating her life to the study of rock art protection, understanding, and the recognition and education, appreciation of rock art. I think that's what rings her chimes. And that certainly is becoming something that I'm interested in as well. And I've been called on to sort of consider and deal with here in the States. So we don't probably have the intensity here in the States that you have in terms of the adversarial nature of the natural environment as a destructive element. But in Nigeria, they had a similar phenomenon because of the rural nature and the unknown value of rock art to the local people. So I can hear what you're saying. Tell us a bit about the challenges you faced in education, appreciation, acknowledgement for the study of rock art.
Yeah, so I was quite fortunate. There are so many communities that are really eager to learn more and embrace it more and understand more about the archaeology in their communities. And I suppose then one of the biggest challenges that I faced, firstly, I'd say anyone who's ever tried to find rock art in Ireland can definitely attest to this, is actually locating the actual panels themselves. Sometimes you'd see the log, you'd see the image of the rock that you're looking for. You'd go to the coordinates where you think it is. You'd go to the landscape, because the landscapes are so vast and they're so rural and there's so many sandstone boulders in the middle of nowhere that you think, say, you'd see one in the distance, you'd be like, that has to be it. And you'd go around and you could spend hours. There was like when I began my research, there was a 2 or 3 days where I went out to these landscapes for the first time and I couldn't find any rock art. And I was like, I must be going mad, you know, where is the art? So that was definitely a challenge. But then I suppose once you really get to know the landscape and the distribution and the areas that you're looking for, you kind of, you know, you find them then. But that's definitely a challenge in the very rural landscapes where you have maybe the coordinates that don't exactly match where they should be and things like that. But otherwise, another thing is a lot of the art is on private land. Much of it is on private land. So you do have to be very careful about, you know, asking permission, asking landowner permission and making sure that you, you know, you're allowed to actually enter the land. So that was another issue. There were some landowners and it was great because some of them are so eager and they're like, oh my God, yeah, the rock, come on, let's go have a look. And, you know, that was great. But I suppose there were some then that were less eager and less enthusiastic to let people onto the land. And that's understandable, I suppose, especially when it comes to having, if they have livestock and stuff like that in the fields.
Sure.
So that is a challenge. But I suppose just hitting back on one of our points from earlier is the recording of the panels. You know, once you have the recording, they're accessible to everybody. So you don't have to bother, you know, somebody and go onto their land. Well, I mean, obviously it's nice to see the real thing, but to actually research it and maybe understand it in the from a motif and context point of view, you have it.
Yeah. It's interesting to talk to someone like you because you have that enthusiasm that I have for the study of rock art. And in the United States, rock art is really not perceived in the same way it is outside of the U.S. I call it an ugly stepchild because they have a flavor of feeling that this particular data set is not as informative, valuable, or insightful as conventional archaeology. Now, I would beg to differ because I think our study of rock art produces some of the most endlessly engaging and unbelievably interesting studies that one can ever have on the face of the planet. And I think you would agree, no?
Oh my God, I totally agree. Yeah, for sure, Alan, I'm totally on board with that. And I would totally agree. And even within the context of rock art in Ireland, like everyone is so obsessed with the megalithic art, whereas this art then is, as I said, much lesser known and, you know, there's less engagement and less, you know, acknowledgement of it at the moment. No, but I totally agree. I would definitely agree with you there.
There is a kind of rock art that was not recognized until relatively recently in California in the Great Basin, the Desert West. A style of rock art that was completely overlooked. Can you imagine?
Oh my God. Yeah. Wow.
And some people call it Nummik scratched or Great Basin scratched. And it appears to be a kind of rock art that was abstract with very, very thin lines created either in association or superimposed over more representational or more physically visible rock art. And what's interesting about that kind of rock art is the more it's been studied, the more scientists believe that it originated with women and it was a female-generated style of rock art.
Oh, wow.
So how would you couch sort of your rock art and your studies of the cup and ring in this value system of rock art? Because I've had to face that myself. They would go, Alan, it's only rock art.
Oh man,
so
that's so hard to hear.
So in other words, you can say whatever you want because we'll never know. I again would not agree with that precept. Please.
No, for sure, Alan. I mean, obviously, I'm with you in that corner in terms of I hate when people say that. Look, it's your rock art. What about the, you know, what about the passage graves or the, you know, stone circle? Or you're like,
yeah.
It rock art definitely deserves to be up there, you know, in its rightful place within the archaeological record. And I suppose what is so interesting, rock art and its different forms, that is really interesting. But I suppose the North Atlantic type, it is garnering more attention, but it would be really nice to see it kind of, I mean, we have to obviously acknowledge that it's never going to be like, people aren't going to, you know, we're not going to get everybody, you know, wanting to visit Ireland, you know, that are going to go to Newgrange and places like that. They're not going to want to be like, actually, do you know what? Now I won't go to Newgrange. I'll just go and look at the North Atlantic art. That won't happen, like in the droves, like there is to the passage grave cemeteries. But that's kind of good, I think, in a way. So, you know, in terms of from a conservation point of view, but just to even have it there as a, okay, we can't tell you exactly what the chronology is or what the meaning is, but it is obviously something of huge significance within the archaeological record and therefore deserves to be protected and promoted and studied further to kind of get that understanding.
And people love a mystery, don't they?
They do, Alan, they do.
So by way of signing out, what would you want to tell our listeners from all over the world about your studies and what you would think, what you'd want them to know or do, or what's the takeaway from this hour?
I think the takeaway is really that there is, in Ireland, in terms of North Atlantic rock art, the numbers of North Atlantic rock art panels are slowly growing and new panels are being recorded as a result of the receding blanket peat and bogs. So, you know, for Irish listeners, I suppose what would be really, really important is, you know, if you do see a piece of rock art or what you think is rock art, make sure, you know, you report it. You know, don't obviously like try to trace it or, you know, interact with the panel surface or anything like that. Report it to the National Monument Service just to make sure that it is listed and therefore, you know, does have legal protection. And, you know, record the art. It'd be great to see more, you know, communities out engaging with archaeology in general, and especially rock art, you know, to make it accessible to everyone. So somebody, you know, sitting in California can click on the, you know, onto the internet and see panels from Ireland, you know. Would be great too, so you can do a full study of Irish rock art from sunny California. That'd be the dream.
Anywhere in the world. Yeah,
exactly.
I love it. Well, with that, I think we'll sign off, and this was a fabulous interlude, and I loved meeting you and talking with you, and I could just feel it and, you know, embrace your passion for your research, your study, and the education and protection of rock art in general. And rock art is a fabulous thing to be involved in. It's endlessly engaging. And just, I can't say enough good stuff about it, right?
For sure. Oh, no, definitely. Yep.
In fact, rock art rocks.
It does.
See you in the flip-flop, gang. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.